Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. Although the latest bombings in Boston don't appear to have overseas fingerprints, we'll begin with an analysis of the national security issues that arise out of this attack on Americans, possibly by other Americans. Heather Hurlburt, the Executive Director of the National Security Network, joins us to discuss how secure our homeland is. Then we will examine the failure of the Senate today to even consider a watered-down bill on expanding background checks on weapon sales and the president's angry response to what he called a shameful day in the nation's capital. Dennis Hennigan, the author of Lethal Logic, Exploding the Myths That Paralyze American Gun Policy, and John Donahoe, the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis, join us to discuss how the gun lobby is able to thwart the will of 90% of Americans. Then finally, we'll examine the Vatican's war against American nuns for promoting radical feminist themes that the new Pope Francis, who has been warmly received by liberal Catholics, is continuing, reaffirming the hardline doctrinal crackdown by his predecessor. Kenneth Briggs, who writes for the National Catholic Reporter and is the author of Double Crossed, Uncovering the Catholic Church's Betrayal of American Nuns, joins us. Joining us now is Heather Hurlburt, who is Executive Director of the National Security Network, where her policy work focuses primarily on the politics of U.S. foreign policy, counterterrorism and resilience, and the nexus of civilian and military approaches to conflict resolution. She has previously served in the White House, State Department, and Congress, and from 1995 to 2001, she served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant and Speechwriter to the President, Speechwriter for Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's policy planning staff. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heather Hurlburt.
Thanks, Ian. It's great to be with you.
And to my mind, what's happening in Boston, and of course, we've been waiting since 5 p.m. Eastern today for a press conference that the FBI and other law enforcement officials were going to hold, where at least the rumors were that they were going to release some evidence of a suspect or even an arrest. But that's been delayed, and it still hasn't happened as of now. But the question that arises to my mind is it gets to the fundamental issue of what national security is. And, of course, throughout the Cold War, there was a rather narrow definition of national security, essentially about how many missiles the U.S. had and how many the Russians had, and largely a bean-counting kind of argument about our national security. But since the transnational and subnational threats have taken over, obviously it is a more murky landscape. But if Americans are killing other Americans with IEDs that we normally associate with the war on terror, what does that say about our own homeland security?
You know, it's really interesting that, in fact, the incidence of domestic terrorism and the fatalities caused by domestic terrorism were much higher in the United States in the 70s than they are now. And yet we didn't, you didn't see as much of the hand-wringing, say, about getting, we had a lot of, relatively speaking, hijackings in the 70s, and you didn't see the hand-wringing about getting on an airplane. So, you know, one of the things, frankly, that's happened is that our definition of security has become more personal. And as our media has become more personalized, we're much more able to be aware of and be obsessive about events that happen. It's also fascinating that, of course, there are many things much more dangerous than terrorism in American life, which we don't obsess about. I mean, now we're all going to worry about pressure cookers in a way that we don't worry about cars, for example. So, you know, the United States does face serious but manageable national security threats, you know, on the level of countries developing nuclear weapons or very real terrorist groups that do wish us ill. And then there's the sort of level of things that are frightening in our daily lives, but that don't, in fact, pose much of a threat to you, Ian, in Southern California, or me, Heather, at my house in Maryland. And our public discourse has really sort of confused the two.
Well, if indeed this is the area of asymmetrical warfare, then the IED seems to be the weapon of choice, does it not?
Well, again, this isn't entirely new. You know, if you remember that the very first World Trade Center bombing was an improvised explosive device in a car. Recipes for extremists, violent extremists of all kinds, to make homemade bombs have been around for a long time. If you knew where to look for them, now they're sort of easier to find on the internet, and we're all more aware of them because of their use in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, it's much less that this is a phenomenon that we've never seen before than that it's a phenomenon that we're now all hyper aware of and that we're able to watch over and over again on TV or on YouTube.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Heather Hilbert, who's Executive Director of the National Security Network, where her policy work focuses primarily on the politics of U.S. foreign policy, counterterrorism and resilience, and the nexus of civilian and military approaches to conflict resolution. Of course, in the era that you mentioned, the 70s, with all the hijackings to Cuba and the anti-war activities, which involved some bombings, we, of course, didn't have this vast bureaucracy known as Homeland Security, which I, you know, believe soaks up about a trillion dollars, I think, since 9/11 has been spent. And that is, of course, in response to 9/11. And in terms of the arenas that you worked in particular with State Department's policy planning staff, I noticed the other day that John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, when he was in, I think, South Korea, mentioned that foreign students were leery of coming to the United States because of the threat of gun violence. And, of course, that has been, I think, reinforced by the death of one of the three people that were killed in this bombing in Boston was a Chinese exchange student. So, as one who has tried to worked in the business of putting America's best foot forward abroad, how important is it as an issue the way that others around the world see the security that we that they question in terms of our national security, you know, which means that they don't feel secure on our streets?
Yeah, I mean, to the first point you made, it is a very important thing for Americans to realize that our Homeland Security spending and our military spending more than doubled in the years after 9/11, and that we have definitely reached a point, and different people will disagree on when we reached this point, but we have certainly reached it where a marginal dollar spent does not buy you another dollar of security, and that's a very hard national conversation that we have to have. As far as sort of how what happens here and what we choose to do here, you know, it has an enormous effect on how we're viewed overseas. You know, and after 9/11, it was almost impossible for many foreign students from many places to get visas. And, you know, foreign students coming to the U.S., which is both a huge source of financial support for universities, a huge source of highly skilled immigration to the U.S., and a huge source of people who go back to their home countries with positive views of the U.S. and rise to senior positions in their own societies favorably disposed to us. You know, all of those things, we really gave ourselves a self-inflicted wound. And, you know, the irony of having this media, which is one of the freest, most open, and, you know, least inhibited for better and for worse in the world, is that yes, you see Chinese chat boards lighting up today with questions about, is it safe to study in the U.S.? Is it safe to study in Boston? You know, anytime something happens in the U.S., those questions arise anywhere that people follow American popular culture, even though, you know, in fact, terrorist attacks happen, terrorist attacks that affect Americans are less than 1% of the total number of terrorist attacks that happen around the world. You know, Boston was only the third or fourth deadliest bombing that happened in the world on Monday. So, you know, we're all mourning and we're all horrified by what we saw. We still have it incredibly good and incredibly safe in this country, But equally, because we have a media and a culture that can look at everything over and over again, we have this perception that we're not safe, and ironically, people in countries that may be less safe than here have that perception too.
So what about the issue, Heather Hilbert, of, I guess, for the want of a better description, of paranoia, in the sense that the militia movement seemed to emerge after the Cold War ended. Now, maybe it was there bubbling beneath the surface in various backwoods, but it really came to the fore after the end of the Cold War. And some analysts, and particularly around the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, made the suggestion that there's a kind of Manichaeanism here, that we had the Soviet enemy for so long that was a perfectly cast bad guy. And then with all of these paranoid theories about black helicopters and UN world government and people surreptitiously putting computer chips in your backside, etc., those scenarios seem to emerge, and it led some to believe that there is a kind of need for an enemy, a kind of quotient of paranoia that we as a culture have.
I would say first that there's a pretty basic, unfortunately, to human beings, temptation to look for enemies. And the greater the uncertainty that human beings find themselves in, and this goes back to your question of how do we define security and how do we think about security as a society, but the more insecure we as human beings feel at any level, the more we seem to look for enemies, to look for in-groups and out-groups. And so, you know, I don't think it's any accident that we became much more aware of extremist activity of all kinds after the Cold War ended. I don't think it's an accident that those incidents rise in periods of economic distress. And I also don't think it's an accident that, you know, frankly, I would look as much at globalization as I would at the end of the Cold War. And the ways that, you know, many of the certainties that people in the United States had about their lives or how their lives would unfold or what their role was in the world, what American culture was, are undermined by a world where we can choose, you know, we can consume culture from all over the world. We can mix with people from all over the world. And we can have our own sort of core beliefs and ways of doing things challenged much more easily than we could in a less media globalized era. And I just think there's no question that any culture has a minority of people in it who react very badly to the challenge of modernity, and that there's going to be a tiny minority of people who react to that violently.
Well, how much, though, is it, for example, the hatred of government or the notion that government is the enemy, which was not first propagated, but certainly in the modern era by Ronald Reagan, and it has become a kind of Republican mantra that government is the problem. And obviously, extremists have taken that on the far right to extraordinary lengths. But what I detect, which I find is a great paradox, is that the far right in this country have this voluntary alienation from a government that they think is evil and in trying to impose and take away their guns. And on the far left, you've got these conspiracy theories about the 9/11 truthers, etc., that ascribe all kinds of extraordinary cleverness and evil intentions to a government that is obviously in many ways incompetent, as it certainly was at 9/11, in not protecting the homeland. And so you have this strange kind of alienation on the far right and the far left in this country. I don't know how big a factor it is, but I find it extraordinary.
You could certainly argue that a common thread uniting many of the of our ancestors who immigrated here, certainly not all, but many, was a healthy suspicion, distaste, or inability to get along with the governments of the society they came from. That certainly happens to be true of my ancestors. So you know, yes, I do think that strand runs very strongly through American culture. I do think, though, it's worth, you know, noticing that one of the things that has puzzled people who were trying to make quick and easy sense of the Boston bombings is that it isn't an attack on a government facility. It is an attack on a government building. You know, it's an attack on something that's a popular symbol of civic pride and of multinational pride. That, you know, to attack the marathon, you had to know that you were going to kill. I mean, you had to know that you were likely to kill and hurt foreigners, not just Americans. So that it is, whatever it is that turns out to be going on here, it's not as simple as someone wanting to attack the government of the United States, either from the left or the right.
But is alienation, I recall there was a book about Bowling Alone written by Harvard Professor Putnam. Is there an unusual amount of sort of voluntary alienation in this country? We've got less than half, quite often half the population even votes, and a number of Americans really, both on the left and the right, feel that the government is alien from them, if not hostile to them. And it seems sort of odd because obviously, you know, you get the government you deserve by the extent to which you participate in it.
It is absolutely clear, by the way, that alienation is one of the biggest predictors for who will turn to violence. And that's true across, you know, whatever kind of terrorism you look at, that it's people who experience being profoundly alienated from their culture. At the same time, it's true that the U.S. has always been a place that both had a vibrant civic culture, just as vibrant a civic culture as any other country, and in some ways vibrant cultures full of people who were really proud of how alienated from their government institutions they were. You know, we have all these myths that we tell ourselves about how marvelously independent we all are, even as, you know, most of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents grew up in tight-knit communities and depended on community support. So, yeah, that's a myth that we use, and it's a myth that clearly gets warped and distorted by folks who have personal alienation issues.
Well, Heather Hilbert, I thank you so much for joining us here. We could have had a much longer conversation, but hopefully we'll talk again.
Pleasure to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Heather Hilbert, who's the Executive Director of the National Security Network, where her policy work focuses primarily on the politics of U.S. foreign policy, counterterrorism and resilience, and the nexus of civilian and military approaches to conflict resolution. She has previously served in the White House, State Department and the Congress, and from 1995 to 2001, she served in the Clinton administration as Special Assistant and Speechwriter to the President, Speechwriter for Secretaries of State Albright and Christopher, and a member of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the failure of the Senate to even consider a watered-down bill on expanding background checks and the President's angry rebuke of the Congress.
Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.